The next T2 Leadership Retreat will take place on the 7th to the 9th of May 2024. To book your place on the Ultimate Leadership Development Experience from the People Performance People, or for more information, please visit www.trans2performance.com.
So welcome to the T2 Hubcast with me, Martin Johnson. And today I've got a special guest, none other than Rich Devinney. Rich, welcome.
Thank you, Martin. It's good to be here. In person, in the flesh, yeah.
Rich is a former Navy SEAL commander, 23 years?
21.
21 years service. Say no more, SEAL Team 6, left the SEALs in 2017.
Yeah.
17, so 6 years almost now. And he's also the author of the book, The Attributes, a fantastic book. So the first recommendation is go out and buy it. And Rich and my paths crossed last year. We invited Rich to the T2 Leadership Retreat. We did a fantastic session on night one. And Rich is over in the UK, so we've dragged him up to Yorkshire in the weather. Yeah. And I thought, I can't let him go without doing a podcast. So Rich, welcome to T2. How has your day been with us so far?
Oh, I mean, phenomenal, as expected, to be honest with you. But it's, love being in the UK, love coming up and seeing different parts. I've never been to Hull, so it's nice to be here and really an honor to be with you. So
awesome. We've just had some meetings and we will not share anything just yet, but all I will say is watch out for some announcements in the future, because we're hoping to bring some of the Attributes work here to the UK.
Yes.
I think we can say that.
I think we can say that. Yeah, I know we can say that.
So Rich, let's podcast. Obviously we've talked a lot about the book, The Attributes, the 25 Attributes of Optimal Performance. There's an updated version of it, which is 42 attributes, which I think we're bringing alive soon. But really what I want to do today is I want to talk around 4 or 5 of the attributes that come up more than most when we do our one-to-one work and when we're helping people try and be more self-aware.
Yeah.
And when they're trying to be the best version of themselves, their best self. So the first one I want to dig into is resilience.
Okay.
And I think the reason I want to dig into that is because you have given, in my mind, the best explanation of resilience that I've heard, which is this notion that it's your ability to return to your baseline state, mm-hmm. mentally and emotionally, when facing adversity, difficulty, or triumph.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting to me, because returning after triumph is not usually synonymous resilience. So first of all, how did you come up with that sort of definition?
Well, one of the first ways was to clearly distinguish it from perseverance, because a lot of times resilience and perseverance get mixed up or conflated. People think to be perseverant is also to be resilient, and perseverance is really this idea that when I get knocked down, I keep getting up. So you get knocked down 7 times, get up 8, right? Which is different than resilience, because perseverance doesn't necessarily require resilience. Resilience is I get knocked down, I get knocked off my baseline, and I return to baseline. So for example, when you get knocked down, you can think of you kind of going low on your baseline, and to recover from that, you need to come back up to baseline.
So just to confirm, your baseline, if you was describe it to a layman, is your comfort zone when you are neither elated nor in adversity.
Yeah, you're
just in that nice baseline of you're in your comfort zone.
So the best analogy is the rubber band, right? You stretch the rubber band and then you let it go and it goes back to its original shape. That's resilience. Yeah. And so how much of a rubber band, how resilient are we? The efficiency and the speed with which we can get back to baseline. And again, it goes for not only challenge, but also triumph, because the importance is as distinct, right? Obviously, if we don't return to baseline after challenge, we will fall into entropy and ill health and things like that. We will descend, go down a kind of a rabbit hole. If we don't return back to baseline after triumph, what can happen is we can fall into complacency, arrogance, and that's just as bad and can lead to just as bad things. So you want to think of resilience as a direction that goes both ways. Obviously, a lot of the resilience we talk about, maybe most of it deals with the challenge and the trauma part of it, but ultimately it can go both ways.
So what's fascinating to me is I've always thought of myself as a resilient person. And then I took the test and my resilience levels based on this definition came out as moderate, which actually makes perfect sense. Because I think what I was judging myself on all along was probably more courage, persistence, durability, things like that. Whereas actually, do I return to my baseline after a trigger quickly? Probably not in some cases. It's not horrendous, it's moderate, right? But if there's people out there who feel like they might be low on resilience or moderate on resilience, where they don't return to baseline quick and their triggers can last quite a long time, my question would be, can you improve resilience, number one, and if so, how?
Yeah, the answer is yes. So there's a couple of ways to think about this. The first thing I'll offer is that you can practice exercising the resilience muscle with what I would define as those little tragedies, you know, and by a little tragedy, I mean the traffic jam, the spat at work or home. And one of the ways you can do that is something that one of my favorite CEOs used to teach us. And it was something his grandfather taught him. It's called the 2-minute rule. And the 2-minute rule went, as soon as something or when something bad happens, you take 2 minutes. You take 2 minutes to kick the dirt, swear, mourn, do whatever you need to do. And after 120 seconds, you come back, you get back to work. You get back to what you're doing. When something good happens, the same thing. You get 2 minutes to, you know, rest on your laurels, pat yourself on the back, whatever it is. And then you get back to baseline after, you get back to work after 2 minutes. Now, this is, again, a way to practice and exercise the resilience muscle, because obviously there are some challenges and traumas that are going to take a lot more than 2 minutes to bounce back from. But you can still exercise that muscle on those little things. You know, when it comes to resilience kind of holistically, we have to think of it in terms of recovery. Recovery is the key to resilience. So in other words, we do something, we achieve something, we go through some sort of challenge or stress. What are we doing to actively recover from that thing? You know, because it's the recovery that's going to get us back up to baseline to allow us to kind of look objectively at it and start to maybe analyze in the way that we can grow from. And so the way we do that is first we recognize it. You have to see it. You have to name it. And then you proactively find ways to recover. The recovery for every human being can be different. I often say, think of joy-inducing activity. And whatever that activity is probably could be a recovery mode. That could be, you know, hanging with family and friends. It could be going for a run. It could be doing yoga. It could be, you know, praying, whatever that is. That's what you need to work on proactively. And so it's really the acknowledgement of it and the acknowledgement of recovery. The reason why someone like you and a lot of top performers are often moderate on resilience or even sometimes low is because a lot of us get really keyed into the accomplishment of the thing or the getting through of the thing. And once we do it, you get a dopamine reward for that. And instead of recovering, we immediately say, okay, what's the next thing? And we go, what can I do now? What's the next challenge? And we forget about the recovery portion. And if we do that over time, we're going to fall into entropy because we're not deliberately practicing resilience.
So true. And what you're saying there is then, depending on the combination of your other attributes, moderate resilience is not a bad thing sometimes, because I do resonate with that. I achieve something, it feels great, and then I'm very quickly on to the next thing. That can be unsustainable if it's relentless, because there's a breaking point, and sometimes you need some time at baseline to recharge. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. No, that really makes sense. So, in order to increase resilience or practice resilience, it's about getting back to baseline. So it's about thinking of actions and activities that you can do which will return you.
Yeah.
And that's different for me, it's playing golf.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's there for only 4 hours I average where I don't think about the business, being a father, being a husband. I just hit this little golf ball around for 4 hours and I love it and enjoy it. Now, for some, golf is an actual trigger.
But for me,
it works.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. Let's come on to another one then that I scored low on.
Okay.
Empathy. And I don't think there's any human being who wants to think that they're low on empathy. I think it's quite an uncomfortable revelation when you go, oh, wow, what does that make me a bad person? But I guess define empathy for me, Rich.
Yeah, empathy is really the ability to feel and absorb feelings of other human beings.
So when you think about that, the ability to feel what another person feels,
yeah.
I don't think you can manufacture that if you don't possess it naturally.
Well, it's so first of all, most of us are, you know, most of us who aren't high on it are simply just a little bit low on it. There are very few people, like you mentioned, who don't have it. That's called a sociopath, by the way.
Yeah.
Sociopaths.
I'm quite a sociopath.
Yeah, yeah. And sociopaths are literally, you know, diagnosed as having no empathy. They just don't have it. Most people aren't that, luckily. And so those of us, because I'm a little low on it too, most of us who are low on it just have to do a little bit more work in terms of trying to put ourselves into the shoes of another human being so that we can start to perhaps feel what they feel. And again, what we want to talk about, what we want to make sure we emphasize about empathy is not about agreeing with someone. To be empathetic doesn't mean you have to agree with them. It really just means you have to put yourself in their shoes. And I know you and I talked about an example that I've given before about a bunch of us SEALs in Iraq. And it's a little bit morbid example, but I mean, you know, I think it's a good one. It was one time we were in Iraq and there was an incident where I think it was a 14-year-old kid attempted to shoot a rocket-propelled grenade, basically a rocket, at a coalition convoy. And of course, they can't let that happen. So they ended up shooting the kid, and the kid was then deceased, which is always unfortunate. You never like to see that. A bunch of us were kind of sitting around the campfire later that evening because we didn't have work that evening. And this came up and we started talking about it. And we all kind of decided to think about, okay, let's just think about this kid. Let's walk that back a little bit. Here's a kid, he's 14 years old. He probably, his dad is probably gone, right? It's probably just him taking care of his mom and maybe his sisters. There's no school, there's no sports, there's no parties, there's no girls, there's no music, there's nothing in the environment for this kid to get his 14-year-old testosterone out on. And then one day some bad guys come and say, we'll give you 100 dinar if you go shoot this rocket at this convoy. And every single one of us SEALs around that fire said we would be that kid. In that environment, we would be that kid. We weren't agreeing with what the kid did, but we could empathize with the kid. And I think to work on our empathy requires a deliberate effort for us to look at someone else's perspective and work to see if we can understand why they feel the way they feel and maybe absorb that and put it into context.
So I have this saying, and I want to check it with you, Rich, around compassion and the difference. So I always say, yes, I'm low on empathy because I do struggle to feel what other people feels a lot of the time. But I therefore try to practice compassion, which says, even though I can't fully feel what you feel, through compassion, I can start to appreciate and try to understand why you may feel that way. Am I describing that correct? Would you agree with that? And how would you describe the difference between compassion and empathy?
Yeah, compassion is its own separate attribute. Compassion is a sympathy. You know, sympathy is not the same. Sympathy is I know how you feel. I can understand how you feel. Empathy is I feel how you feel. So I would agree with you that compassion is a door to empathy. But you can't just stop at sympathizing. To be empathetic, you must go in, you step into the room of, okay, I can sympathize, I can understand how they feel, but now what do I need to do to feel how they feel, really absorb that? That takes work. It's a tough one to work on, but again, one of the things I try to do to work on my empathy is I typically try to find people whose perspective and opinions are vastly different than mine, and then attempt to see if I can feel First, sympathize, right? Say, okay, I can see how they feel that way. Now, can I start to feel how they feel? You know, and those views could be, you know, about anything, you know, but.
Even if you then conclude, I sympathize and I can appreciate how you feel, but I still fundamentally disagree.
Oh, of course, because we can say, hey, listen, I feel how you feel. I still think it's wrong, in my opinion, but I feel, and you can almost, you know, some of the hardest environments is politics, right? If you can just pick the party whose politics you disagree with the most and start to see if you can empathize with why those people may feel the way they feel. And then it probably won't change your opinion or your belief in your own opinion, but it'll certainly give you way more perspective on what they
and
what they
even that in itself, the gesture of that is going to lead to more hopefully fruitful relationships, better conversations, and more understanding.
Yeah, you're exercising that empathy muscle. The more often you do that, the more natural it will become, and therefore you create an automatic, a habitual response to someone. Say, okay, without thinking, I'm actually putting myself in their shoes. You know, that's how you develop that muscle.
Are you a fan of our podcast? If so, make sure you're following us on all of our social media channels. You can find us on TikTok, Instagram, YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter by searching Trans2 Performance. By following us, you'll have access to exclusive content, special announcements, and more. Join the T2 community today.
Okay, let's jump into another one that I scored low on, open-mindedness. Yeah. My wife's watching this, she's smiling. But open-mindedness. So again, I've got this double whammy in my results here that says you're unempathetic or low on empathy and you are not the most open-minded person. I do agree with it. And I think it is something that I'm low on because there's always a trade-off between your strengths and your areas to build on. How does this differentiate and what's the potential dangers of that?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there can be a connection between empathy and open-mindedness, but you know, a low open-mindedness can also be just an effect or a symptom of very high drive, you know, and a stubbornness and a drive to, hey, I want to just get this done. And that type of resolve sometimes creates a myopic kind of tunnel vision approach that doesn't allow for the ability to see other perspectives. And so open-mindedness is really, can you first understand that you're in a fishbowl and then try to see the perspective outside the fishbowl. It's like, I love the idea that a fish doesn't know what water is because they're in it. They're surrounded by it, right? So we're the only ones who kind of know what a water is because we can see the fish in the water, right? So can you get outside your fishbowl? And you can work on this by, again, seeing if you can obtain or think about angles of something that you might not have thought about. So a great example of this, I was working with a company in the US and they were a big construction company. And these guys were really awesome. I mean, and they were what I would define as uber patriots, right? I mean, just loved the US, loved the country, really pro-military, pro-gun, everything. Super, super guys, but like uber patriots. And so, and I don't even say, but they were. I don't say it like it's a derogatory thing, but one of their top attributes for their company, for their organization, was open-mindedness, and they thought that made real sense. And I was talking to the CEO, and he said, "But Rich, how can I ask a question to measure someone or get a sense of someone's open-mindedness?" And I said, "Well, let me give you an example." He said, "Okay." I said, "Give me three reasons right now to burn the American flag." And you can see when I asked him that, he almost had an aneurysm, right? You know, because what I was doing is I was immediately taking him outside of his fishbowl and trying to get him to think about something in a way that he just is not used to thinking about. Because I could give three reasons really easily. And so, and I'm a former military guy, right? But the question forced him outside of his fishbowl, right? And so open-mindedness is the act of getting yourself outside your fishbowl. And to practice it is not actually that hard. It can feel hard, it can feel uncomfortable, but it's really just, you know, you're presented with an opinion, opportunity, experience that you otherwise would not have had, and you just roll with it, you know? You just say, okay, let me see how this, you can be uncomfortable, but let me just see how this can be. And that's a way to practice that.
And for me, I was obviously high, I scored high on some of the attributes like self-efficacy.
Yeah.
Persistence. So you would see that a natural trade-off
for
that might be low open-mindedness. Is if you're high on open-mindedness and low on, say, self-efficacy and some of the drive attributes, could that be slightly counterintuitive for you? Like you're too open-minded.
And well, that would... So high open-mindedness and low self-efficacy would likely present itself as someone who is very, very easy to get along with and work with, and they're open to most anything, but they generally just can't get anything done because they're probably often just waiting for the next perspective, right? So high efficacy and low open-mindedness could be detrimental. Although you and I, it might take a little time, but we might start to be able to think of some roles where that might be an asset. So I never try to put judgments on these things unless they're extreme. If they're extreme, it's usually a bad thing. So in other words, extremely high on open-mindedness and extremely low on self-efficacy, that can probably be a bad thing. But those scores don't necessarily mean it's a bad thing. It just depends on what context
you're in. Just depends on what role you're doing or what you're trying to achieve.
Right.
Let's go into adaptability. I think it's one of the words that is used quite a lot in our work with clients. In this ever-changing world, change is always inevitable. And you need to be adaptable to respond to a changing environment.
Yeah.
I think in the SEALs, you talk a lot around adaptability is a huge attribute for SEALs because, am I right in saying that you called frogmen because the frog is the animal that has adapted the most over time. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, and again, back in the day, they were the underwater demolition team. So everything was coming from the water and this idea that you're amphibian, which is you come from the water and you're on land, you go back to the water, whatever. And I think that's where the frog analogy stuck.
Right. But adaptability is this ability to adapt to a changing environment.
Yeah.
And some people possess it naturally.
Yeah.
I scored high on adaptability. I resonate with it. But other people struggle with it.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's almost not, I almost hesitate to say it's the ability to adapt. It's the ease with which you can adapt. In other words, it's a very reactive attribute. So the environment's changing around you outside of your control. How easily can you just go with the flow and roll with it? How comfortable is that for you? And I think a lot of us are moderate. I wouldn't even say as a SEAL I'm high on adaptability. I do like some structure of certainty in what I'm doing, especially if you're in combat. I mean, you don't want it to be too off the wall. However, when it does happen, I can basically go with the flow and roll with it. And so it's a reactive thing. It's going to involve some other attributes. Open-mindedness helps exercise adaptability. Curiosity is a really good one. And again, curiosity and open-mindedness sometimes get conflated. Open-mindedness is this passive openness, where curiosity is this proactive openness. So in other words, if you and I go to Thailand, for example, and we meet our local friend there, and our local friend says, hey, I'm going to take you to the most authentic Thai restaurant. You and I are like, okay, great. That's open-mindedness. Or we go to Thailand, we meet our local friend, we say, hey, take us to the most authentic Thai restaurant. That's curiosity. Curiosity, there's a proactivity to the act, right? So adaptability can be helped or exercised with open-mindedness or curiosity. It can be helped and exercised by an understanding or a recognition that kind of let's see what happens, or let's go with the flow here. A recognition that you can't change what's happening. That's a big one, because if you feel like you're someone who has to change things or has to make something be or make something so, it's going to be likely that adaptability will be uncomfortable for you. So it's almost an acceptance level. So the more you can accept and be at peace with, I mean, where you and I might be traveling somewhere and we have a tight timeline and our plane keeps on getting delayed. We can either sit there and get pissed off about it, or we can say, you know what, there's not much we can do right now, other than maybe look for some other flights, but we just have to adapt. We just have to figure out what the next step is, because we're not going to change what's going on. And I think that those who are low in adaptability are people who tend to feel like or really want to change things. And it's, you just can't. That's the whole point. And so I think a recognition is a big piece.
And the last one we're going to talk about for this podcast before we just finish up with a general closing chat is cunning. Because when you wrote the book, The Attributes, there were, in my mind, there were two of the attributes of the original 25 that were controversial. And they're not controversial other than the fact of the traditional stigma that comes with them. And that was narcissism and cunning.
Yeah.
So let's look at cunning, because that's an interesting one. Cunning in the UK, right? In our understanding, would suggest sly, sneaky,
deceitful.
Yeah, yeah. But you have it as actually it can be quite a good attribute for performance, optimal performance.
Yeah, cunning at its baseline, at its basic level, is the idea of problem solving outside the box, right? It's outside the box thinking. And what the cunning mind, obviously a hugely important attribute for Navy SEALs, but what the cunning mind does typically when approached with a problem or approaching a problem, asks three questions. And the first question is, are there rules and boundaries? The second question is, are they real or are they perceived? And then the third question is, if they are real, what happens if I break them? Okay. And then the cunning mind begins to look at ways to think around the problem, right? And so I always say cunning itself at its basic level is not is neither good or bad. It's the way we employ it that can then be judged as good or bad, right? If we choose to employ it in a deceitful way or a negative way, that is bad. Bernie Madoff, or the whole Enron scandal years ago, that's an example of malevolent cunning, right? Oscar Schindler, on the other hand, is an example of benevolent cunning, right? Yeah. He went outside the rules and the box to save lives, right? He was very cunning, but it was good cunning, right? So as a baseline, cunning is an incredibly valuable attribute in the drive category.
So what I take from that then, Rich, is actually what the major thing that counts with cunning is, what is the intent behind it? Because if the intent is for the greater good, then being cunning is a really good thing.
Yes.
If the intent is for personal gain over to somebody else's detriment,
yes,
then it's not a good thing.
That's right.
So it's not the cunning element that's the problem. It's the intent behind it that could be.
100%. Yeah. Because again, I mean, this is a whole other podcast, but good and bad are also subjective. You know, so we just have to, I always hesitate to place judgment on any of these because if we take it to that base level, now we're talking performance.
Please consider leaving a 5-star review on your favorite podcasting platform. It only takes a minute and your feedback is greatly appreciated. Reviews help other people find the show and learn about the amazing topics we cover. Additionally, please turn on notifications so you never miss an episode. And finally, please subscribe or follow the T2 Hubcast if you haven't already. Doing this means that you'll automatically receive new episodes as soon as they're released. Thanks so much for your support.
The final thing I want to talk about, Rich, to sort of round this all off, because by the way, if you're interested, and we've talked about 5 attributes there, there's 25 in the book, there's 42 in the New Test Online. But what I sort of want to talk about, and it ties in with our work here as T2, as you know now, is my philosophy has always been, when it comes to developing people and teams, it's not about good or bad. It's not about saying anybody's better than anybody else. It's about looking at a person's DNA. And what we know is you are pretty much made up through your nurture and nature.
Yeah.
And different neuroscientists and people will say 60-40, mm-hmm, 50, you know, 55-45,
right,
nurture versus nature. We know that they're both integral to forming who you are. You know, your nature being your genetic coding passed down from your parents, your nurture being your influences from parents, social exposure, educational years, you know, the things that your environment that's influenced you. But either way, what I'm sort of saying is, however you're made up, you're going to have high, moderate, low.
Yeah.
We call it best self and shadow. It's not important that you're good at everything. Nobody can be. And it's not to be deterred by the fact that you're low on stuff, because there's trade-offs in, yes, our personality.
Right.
I can't be really high on self-efficacy, accountability, drive, all of these things, and not have a trade-off,
right,
which is low on empathy or open-mindedness.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's neither good nor bad. It's about understanding what your blueprint is,
yes,
embracing it,
yes,
and saying, I don't think I'm ever going to be high on empathy and open-mindedness, but nor should I be really.
Yeah, and it's really the context that you're operating in life. I always use the analogy of automobiles, because I like to think that human beings are like automobiles. In other words, every automobile has the same parts. They have tires, frame, steering wheel, carburetor, engine, okay? But there are Jeeps and there are Ferraris, and the Ferrari is way different than the Jeep. And there's no judgment, because the Jeep can do things the Ferrari can't do, and the Ferrari can do things the Jeep can't do. They're still automobiles, but we have to lift our hood and see what we're running with. And our unique set of attributes starts to speak to that type of distinction. You know, what does my unique set bring to my experience? And you may be feeling friction in your life right now, because you might be a Jeep that's been trying to run on a Ferrari track, or vice versa, right? So I think this idea of self introspection and self work allows us to understand, okay, what do I come to the table with, and can I align my overall objectives and goals so that it fits who I am? And again, there might be opportunity in there to say, you know what, I am low on empathy, and empathy in the genre I'm currently in, working on it could help, right? But it takes that list of ones you're low on, and it makes it much, much shorter, right? To say, okay, I don't have to, just because I'm low on 10, that doesn't mean anything. I mean, it'd be bad if I were higher on a couple of things, but I can see this one or two, by developing this, might help my race, if you will, right? So But I think that's the way we look at it. You know, what is our unique profile and how does that fit inside of the context we're in? And yeah, high, low, it no one can be high, nor should they be high on all of them. That would be both impossible and a disaster, you know?
Yeah. Final question, Rich, an intrusive one, a testing one. Let's come out of sort of the content and the knowledge around attributes and psychology and what we're talking about. You as a person, former Navy SEAL, SEAL Team 6, several tours of Iraq and Afghanistan, have operated in high-pressure environments, etc. Question for you. Everybody would associate and say, well, you've got it nailed, right? There's no weakness. But when have you felt most recently most vulnerable, out your depth, unsure, anxious? It happens to us all, right? And has it changed since you left the military? Because you're in a completely different field.
Yeah, so I often say every human being, just like every automobile, I mean, the Jeep is awesome in certain environments and just completely miserable in others. That's like us, right? We are rock stars in certain contexts of our lives and doofuses in others, right? And so I think it's those contexts that we are not rock stars in, or that are new to us, that allow us to start really figuring some of this stuff out. And I think the transition for any military, and you know this because you've experienced it, that is a huge transition, because you're going from a very, very distinct regimented and certain identity, and you're throwing that away, and you're going to create a new one, whatever that is. What's interesting is what people don't realize, and I talk to veterans who are transitioning about this all the time. It takes the same attributes, and one of the most important ones is courage. And in the military, you've exercised your courage before, right? So all you need to do is exercise your courage again. And the courage is, like we've talked about, it's not the absence of fear; it's the ability to step into fear and discomfort. And so I think for me, coming out of the military and getting into a leadership space, especially, speaking in front of people, that was something I really had to step into and get used to.
So despite being a commander in the SEALs and given numerous presentations and training workshops and stuff, coming out and speaking in public in the corporate world or at conferences or in front of people, that put fear into you?
It's a whole different context. Because again, fear is subjective, right? What makes us afraid, what causes our autonomic arousal to start firing up is subjective to the user. And so I always say, like, the Navy SEAL in a firefight in Afghanistan with Al-Qaeda could literally be feeling less physiological fear than the 8-year-old you just asked to stand up in front of their classroom and give a presentation, right? That child may be literally feeling more fear in their system because of the context, right? Because the SEAL might be just used to that or be able to manage it, whatever. So fear is subjective, and that which makes us anxious, that which brings our autonomic arousal up, is subjective.
Would you say you have a fear of rejection? So you come out of a place where you're at the top of your game, you're highly respected, you have a depth of knowledge in it, and you go into this corporate leadership world, and although you fully have courage and you're backing yourself and you know what you... It's this, will I get found out? Will this land in this environment?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we just did our prints, right? One of my prints was, I am someone who likes to know things and likes to be knowledgeable about things. So one of my fears coming out and speaking in front of people is, oh, I hope they don't think I don't know, right?
Yeah.
That's a fear, right? And I wouldn't even say it's not even fear of rejection. I mean, rejection is ultimately what most people fear, you know, but it's this fear that I look like I don't know. And coming out of the military, I was working with, you know, Simon Sinek, who's a friend, and a couple other leadership institutes, and I was actually speaking on their stuff, which is even harder because now I have to absorb their stuff and talk and speak about it. So did I understand it to the depth I needed to? And it was ugly the first couple of times, right? But this is the type of exercise. And what I was doing there, I was simply exercising my courage.
Yeah. I said last question twice, but this is definitely last question. Last week here in the UK, we had Mental Health Week, Awareness Week. We always do different things for each year. The topic this year was anxiety. Mm-hmm. Anxiety is something that a lot of people experience.
Yeah.
I guess if there was one tip from you, if people were experiencing what we would say levels of anxiety, which are above your normal fight or flight kicking in at most appropriate time. So you're starting to become generalized with it. Is there any tips, advice from you on how people could sort of try to start to overcome this?
Well, there's a lot, right? But just what we have to understand about anxiety is it's a physiological response, and it is literally our nervous system, our autonomic nervous system, engaging and starting to ramp up. And as we become more anxious, we have physiological effects. A couple of those effects are visual and respiratory, right? So, for example, our vision begins to tunnel, become myopic, kind of close in. You get tunnel.
And that's because back in the day, tunnel vision helped us focus on the threat.
Focus on the threat, right? And so that happens. And then breathing becomes more rapid because, again, that's your adrenaline's kicking. You need to, you're firing up a lot of systems to then survive. So one of the things, the way we can think about this is we can actually reverse the process sometimes physiologically. One really cool, simple trick is visually called open gaze. And the way I would describe this is if you were to pick a point on a wall and just look at that point for a second, but then soften your eyes, right? Soften your gaze so that you're now noticing, you're not staring at that point anymore. You're just noticing all your periphery. It's called soft gaze or open gaze. This process has literally been proven to bring your autonomic arousal down. And the reason is because what you're doing is you're deliberately injecting into the process this desire to mitigate tunnel vision. You're opening your gaze and mitigating tunnel vision. So they've tested this, and this brings your anxiety down. A lot of the times I would get on stage the very first time and I'd start to feel nervous, I would just go into open gaze. I start to notice my periphery. So that's a visual tool that's really simple.
I'm doing it right now. Yeah. So I've been looking at you intently this podcast, and you're explaining it. So I'm starting to notice the camera to the right. Mm-hmm. I'm noticing the sign on the wall to my left. There's an air conditioning unit up there. And I'm not really breaking where I'm looking, but I'm definitely opening up my peripheral vision.
Yeah, and you're starting to feel more relaxed.
Yeah, I am. Let's go for another half hour.
Yeah. So that's a visual tool. A quick respiratory tool is something called CO2 blowout breathing, because what we have to understand is the anxiety we feel, for example, when we're holding our breath, is not because of a lack of O2. It's because of a buildup of CO2. So the buildup of CO2 causes your body to start feeling like it needs to breathe and anxious. And so blowing out your CO2, there's a couple ways to do that. But one of the most popular ways, and my buddy Huberman talks about this, is this idea that you take one full deep breath and then top it off. So, and then a nice slow exhale. You do that 5 or 6 or 7 times, even 10 times, and you are blowing out CO2, and you'll start to begin to bring down your autonomic arousal, i.e. bring down your anxiety. Your frontal lobe will start coming back online. You'll find yourself being able to make more deliberate conscious decisions in that.
So if you feel yourself, what they call a panic attack, panicky, and your breath is closing in, that's a really good physical exercise you could do 4 or 5 times to just...
To start coming down off of that. You might be able to do it 10 times, but coming down off of that, it works. It really does.
Yeah. Let's finish this podcast by putting you on the spot and saying you can ask me one question, anything you like, to finish the podcast.
Okay. What scares you?
I guess I'm going to give you 2 answers. The first answer is a silly one, but it does scare me. So I've got to be honest with it, which is I've got an irrational fear of anything that could fly and sting you. Wasps. If I'm trapped in a car or in a room with a wasp, and this is really bizarre because spiders, snakes, any other creature, not bothered.
Yeah.
It seems to be anything that flies, which is faster than me, which can sting, right? Yeah. And I don't know where it comes from. I've never been stung. But my wife laughs at me because she has to get the wasps out in the house. So that's a particularly silly one, but I start sweating. I sweat. Absolutely. I think psychologically and more deep in my sort of mentality, I would say failure.
Yeah.
I think that's my sense of purpose. It always has. I have this deep fear of looking bad, failing, and what that would mean for me, my reputation. So there's obviously some deep-seated probably insecurity in that, but a lot of people would view you and say, you're confident, courageous, you're running a successful business, you're doing this, and you've got no problems. But what's behind all of that is this deep-seated fear of it all going wrong. So I think those 2 things, bees or wasps, not so much bees because they're good, but wasps, and I would say looking bad in front of others or failing would be a big one for me.
I think that's great. And the reason why I asked that question is really to give an example to the audience, because it's not a bad question to ask ourselves once in a while to say, okay, what is it that I actually am afraid of? What causes that fear? Because the more we understand that, the more we can actually name it and tame it, I guess, because the more you can engage your conscious mind into the process of autonomic arousal, that's also an effect bringing down your anxiety because you're thinking through it.
Well, I think as well, my answer to that question is, if I think to the things that put me into shadow state, i.e. the things that trigger me when I'm not at my best,
yeah,
is when I think that I'm failing,
yeah,
or we are failing.
Right.
When I think that we are not, we are dropping the ball, or we are not heading in the right direction, or we're not producing what our clients want, or we're not making people happy in the workplace, or whatever it might be, I think all of my triggers are around when I believe, and sometimes it's only a perception,
yeah,
when I believe that we're failing.
Yeah.
And then you stop looking at all the wins, you stop looking at all the stuff that we've actually achieved, and you just really hone in on the things that are making you unhappy. And I'm not good to be around when that happens. So I've got to get myself out really quickly. So I think it's an important question to answer, because it can almost give you a bit of a guideline as to where all your triggers.
100%, 100%. And honestly, it separates fear into what fear actually is. There's present fear or uncertainty, which is real, and that's something you are in active reaction or engagement into. And then there's future fear and uncertainty, which is all fiction. So understanding those fictions allow you to actually think about them a little bit more deeply, because they aren't real if they're in the future. So
I call that practical and hypothetical worrying. So practical worries are things in the here and now that I can deal with, that I can do something about, and then it will subside. Hypothetical is what, and I have it two ways, like you say, what we perceive may happen in the future,
yeah,
or what has already happened in the past that we can't control, either of them. So we're hypothetically worrying. And I think generally people we coach who do struggle with anxiety and worries are hypothetical worries.
Yes.
It's quite often the things that they will never happen,
oh, yeah,
but they perceive they might. Yeah. That must be a challenging place to get out of. But
in our day and age, in today's modern environment, 99% of fear is hypothetical, is future, is fiction, right? Because we're in a safe environment. Not many bad things are happening, at least to most people in the present moment.
Yeah.
So
awesome. Rich Devinney, we're going to finish it there. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here in person. I've loved spending the day with you. Thank you for doing the pod. And what I'll say to the listeners is watch this space for some announcements in the future, where hopefully we're going to bring more of the attributes to the UK. And we're going to collaborate more in the future.
Absolutely. Looking forward to it.
And we'll be back shortly with another T2 Hubcast.